like to welcome Juliet Morgan from the University of Oklahoma. She'll be presenting on acquisition in the context of language revitalization, adult L2 learner varieties of Chickasaw, which I'm very interested in myself. There will be 20 minutes and 10 minutes for questions at the end.
Thank you. Thank you everyone for coming today. I'm really excited to share with y'all some of my dissertation research. I've been working with Chickasaw and the adult learners in one of their immersion programs. So first, Chickasaw is a Muskogean language that's spoken in southern Oklahoma. They have around 50 speakers who are all bilingual in English as well as Chickasaw. They have a dedicated language revitalization program that's been very active, and their primary focus right now in terms of revitalization is to create new, conversationally proficient adult learners of the language. They had a traditional master apprentice program for several years, but in 2015 they switched over to this new group model that they call the Chickasha Academy, and that's been the focus of my dissertation research. In the academy, okay, I think you can still read that. Thank you. The academy is like master apprentice in that it brings together the fluent speakers with the younger adults who want to learn the language, but unlike master apprentice, they meet as a large group. The sessions are semi-structured around a loose curriculum, and the sessions are led by the experienced learners. So the experienced learners have a key role in this method of immersion. They mediate between the linguistic abilities of the fluent speakers and the new learners who come into the program. When the new learners begin the program, they usually have no experience with immersion and very little experience with the language. But the experienced learners make sure that everyone stays involved and that everyone keeps talking. It's really conversation-based. And from the first day, the new learners have to speak. They have to participate and take time and communicate and engage in the language. As part of their documentation, the language revitalization program records all the Chickasha Academy sessions. And then I have access to those recordings, and I transcribe them. And that's where all of the data is coming from today. So the recordings that I have a big mix of linguistic abilities between the new learners, the experienced learners, and the native speakers. And in language acquisition research, when we're talking about linguistic abilities, most often we refer to the fluency levels that are defined by the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. So their website has a lot more information on what these look like. I just have a brief statement about what a learner can do at each level. Not only linguistic abilities, but in language acquisition research, we can talk about what a learner's understanding is of how the language works at that level, and that's usually referred to as their learner variety. Given the right conditions, a learner's variety will progress through these different levels. Most of the data that I have is at the novice and intermediate variety, so I'm focusing on those two today. And I'm looking at how do the learners progress between these levels? How do they go from novice to intermediate, and what does that look like in Chickasaw? The intermediate level is very important because that's the goal of the Chickasha Academy, to get the learners to the intermediate mid-level after 2 years in the program. So in looking at the different learner varieties, I'm focusing on a few grammatical features. These are the ones that the learners pick up the earliest. So Chickasaw is an active state of language. It has other types of pronominal prefixes as well, but these are the first ones that the learners pick up. There are a lot of exceptions, but the active state of system is underlyingly motivated by control, and it's pretty salient, so the learners pick that up pretty quick. In terms of tense, present tense is unmarked in Chickasaw, but there are suffixes for a simple past and a future, and they pick those up. Those are the first two they pick up. And then one of the most important differences between the novice variety and the intermediate variety is the ability to create more connected series of discourse. And they need connectives to be able to do that. So to move from those simple disconnected sentences to connected sentences. Chickasaw has a lot of different ways of connecting things together. It depends on what you're connecting. There's a word that means and, but it can only be used between nouns. If you're going to connect between verbs, you have to make use of Chickasaw's extensive switch reference system. There are many different switch reference suffixes, but the first two that the learners pick up are the ones for and. So there's cha and na for same subject and different subject. So looking at what this looks like for the learners, this is an example of a novice low variety. This is from a new learner that came into the program when it started in 2015. This is on his second day. He's had 5 hours of immersion. He was asked the question, "What did you do last night?" He has no inflection in his response, but he's basically picked up these vocabulary words and he tries to communicate with them. In this line right here in the bold, I have all the missing inflection that he would have used if he was communicating what he wanted to say. So he's missing all those features that I mentioned. There's no tense or person or switch reference. But with more time and input, this learner, this is the same learner, he progressed to the novice mid. This is an example of his response to the question, what did you do this morning? He appropriately marks every verb with past tense. He marks every verb with person. He uses both an active suffix or an active suffix and a stative prefix. And I have those highlighted in red, the person markers. These verbs are all really high frequency. They've been priming and practicing those during the session. So while he's using the appropriate markings, some of these are memorized. More time, more input. This is at the end of his first year, his last assessment. And he's had around 600 hours of immersion. This is in response to the same question, what did you do this morning? You can see this response is much longer. It's still disconnected, simple sentences, but he wants to try and connect them. So he's still properly marking everything with past tense. He's using both active and stative suffixes. But he isn't quite gotten switch reference yet. Instead of using the switch reference suffix on the verb, he tries to use that freestanding connective word mitcha, which can only be used between nouns. So it means and, but not in the way that he's trying to use it. And this is the sort of first step that learners make when they're trying to connect. They all try to grab onto that mitcha word rather than using a suffix. But the intermediate learners do start to pick up the switch reference system. So I have their switch reference markers highlighted in purple here. And this is from a different learner who was at the intermediate low level. This was looking at a picture, and he was asked to tell a story about what's going on in the picture. So he uses the appropriate same subject ending cha to indicate and between the two clauses. He's using both present and both future and past tense. He does try to use another switch reference suffix that's a little more complicated. The hotoko and hotoko suffixes indicate because. They also indicate the switch reference. I mean, they're part of that system. But then you have to attach them to the right clause to get the right meaning. So he's attached it to not quite the right clause. He was trying to say the woman is happy because the man gave her a blanket. But he said, because the woman is happy, the man gave her a blanket. But they're getting to that level of creating these connected utterances. So traditionally, learner variety studies often compare the learner varieties not only amongst each other, but to how native speakers would speak the language, right? So the intermediate learners, they are acquiring some complex morphology. But if we compare their variety to the native speaker variety, there are some really big differences in how they're using the language. And these are a few of the differences that I've observed. They regularly don't mark a case that's described as obligatory. They try to use connective verbal suffixes as standalone words. And then they also appear to have simplified this complicated use of the dative. So the dative is another set of agreement affixes that Chickasaw has in addition to the active statives that I mentioned. The active stative system is pretty semantically salient, but the dative affixes are syntactically motivated and not semantically predictable, and the learners have the most trouble with those out of the three sets. So looking at dative agreement in Chickasaw, I'm going to focus on this one as an example of what the intermediate variety is doing that's different than how Chickasaw is described as functioning. So the dative affixes, as I said, they developed syntactically. They originally marked an applicative object on active and stative verbs, and I have an example here of an active verb with the dative and a stative verb with the dative, and you can see how it adds in another object. But through some syntactic changes, datives can also mark the subjects of verbs. So for learners, it's difficult sometimes to tell if the dative is marking the subject or the object. And I have data of the learners trying to conjugate the stative-seeming verb with the stative suffixes instead of the dative, and this more active-seeming verb lost with an active subject instead of the dative. So this is a system that even the intermediate learners still mix up. But the have constructions in Chickasaw are where there's some really interesting changes going on. In the descriptive literature, these constructions are described as having a double nominative. So they developed through some syntactic processes, including possessor raising. And I don't have time to show all the different steps as to how they developed. But the end result is this kind of odd double nominative construction in Chickasaw. So you don't usually have a clause in Chickasaw that has two arguments not marked as nominative. This only happens in these dative constructions. But the way that the intermediate learners use these verbs, it appears that they've reanalyzed these as dative subject verbs. So for the learners, these verbs mean something like to have an animate object. This is a really complicated system. Chickasaw has many sets of positional verbs that indicate the position, the number, and sometimes the animacy of the subject. So we have the set here of Anta, Ashwa, and Ayesha, and they indicate animates that are there as singular, dual, or triplural. And then the have constructions, a dative is added in there. For the learner data, you can see that they don't mark anything nominative. They've gotten rid of that double nominative construction, and they only are using the dative as a subject to say things like, I have two dogs, or I have so many kids. A lot of the learner sessions really focus on talking about yourself and who you are and what your relations you have. So these are really high frequency for them, talking about how many kids they have, how many relatives they have, or how many pets they have. As I mentioned, traditionally, learner variety studies often compare what the learners are doing with what a native speaker would do. This comparison usually requires really good description of what native speakers do, and this is difficult for a lot of endangered language communities that don't have those descriptions. With Chickasaw, there's been a fair amount of descriptive work, but there's a disconnect between what the descriptive work describes Chickasaw as doing and what the speakers who are involved in the academy are doing. The descriptive work is largely based on the speech of a speaker who is not involved in the academy. So that variety is just as not as large a part of their input as the way that the speakers speak who are in the academy. So when I first started this work, I was being very traditional and comparing the learner varieties against what was described and seeing all these changes and going, wow, what is going on? It looks like a lot of simplifications. But when I started looking at the input variety, I realized that that was not what was going on. The learners are more successful than I thought they were. They are picking up what is in the input variety. The changes, like with the dative have construction that I just showed, are what the speakers do. The speakers have changed that double nominative construction and are now using it as a dative subject verb. And that's what the learners are picking up. So here's some examples of the speakers talking to the learners and asking them questions. Do you still have a dog? Do you have four kids? And they're using those datives in this new construction where they've analyzed them as a dative subject verb rather than the described variety with the double nominative marking. So most of the literature, there's very little literature about language acquisition with endangered languages, and less of that focuses on adults who are acquiring their language. There are very few studies, but in the literature, you do sometimes find field linguists who will sort of make observations about what they've observed in the community, and a lot of times they mention that the speakers they work with speak a certain way, and they describe that way, and then the younger adults in the community speak this different way. So it's not as much of a systematic study, but there's comments about this. Most often, they describe what the younger adults are doing as simplifications. So like I said, that's what I came into this thinking, like, wow, these are these simplifications that everyone's been talking about. I see them in the language. But with the Chickasaw data that I've been working with, we have this unique opportunity to actually analyze the input that the learners are getting because the language evaluation program has been dedicated to documentation and recording the sessions. So we can see that their input is actually the source of these changes and not the learners themselves. So the learners are successfully acquiring what they're given and not making these changes. And I'm curious if that's what has been going on in some of these other communities, but I don't know them enough to comment on that. So through this research, I think there will be more language acquisition research on endangered languages. I think it's growing. And I would just caution that future studies be careful about comparing what the learners are doing to what's described, because I think it could diminish the true successes that the learners are having. And I think it also, looking at language acquisition in the context of language revitalization from a traditional perspective, also overshadows the agency of the learners and of the revitalization programs. Many communities are aware that language acquisition is going to cause some changes in the community, but that doesn't mean that they have no control over what these changes are going to be or how they're going to be. And the Chickasaw Language Revitalization Program refers to this as mediated language change. So language change is probably going to happen, but we have some control over it, and we can mediate it in some ways. And their way is through the academy, by doing these intense immersions and documenting what's going on in the academy. So while the learner varieties do show what may look like expected simplifications due to perhaps first language interference, a closer look at the input variety shows that these changes come from the speakers and that the learners are picking up what they should be picking up from the speakers. So I think future studies should just be mindful of that. Additionally, language documentation as a field has been criticized for not documenting enough, not documenting the variation that's in the community, or focusing on perhaps an older or more conservative form instead of documenting what language variety is actually in use in the speech community. And I think while that's been articulated, I don't think I've seen a discussion of how that could impact language acquisition as it has, or as it could potentially, if people are relying on those described varieties and unable to document the input variety. That disconnect could diminish what kind of successes the learners have had. So, thank you to the Chickasaw Nation and their Language Revitalization Program, and thank you to the NSF. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
Yeah, this is like exactly what I'm interested in. And I have a million questions, but I'll just stick with one.
Okay.
So this is mostly about morphosyntax. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about Chickasaw phonology, but I would imagine that it differs from English phonology in certain ways.
Yes, I'm not looking at phonology at all.
Yeah. Have you noticed, just anecdotally, have you noticed anything? What kinds of things have you noticed going on with phonological acquisition?
Chickasaw does have really interesting phonology. They have a lot of regular phonological rules. I've noticed the same thing. So some of the speakers don't apply all the phonological rules. So the learners are getting both input, like a phonological rule being applied and a phonological rule not being applied. So for example, there's a verb, a really high-frequency verb to like, I punchy, and there's a regular rule that it changes. So instead of I punchily, you get I poshly. And some speakers say I punchily, and some speakers say I poshly. One thing that I didn't get to is that the goal of language revitalization is to create intergenerational transmission, but that's also recreating these relationships. And when the learners are getting two different inputs, they kind of speak like who they are closer to. You know, like those are the voices in their head. They're emulating those people. When they're both in the input, they kind of like their choice sort of depends on other factors. But it's like a similar thing where if I had just seen learners doing Ike Ponchily, it would have been like, wow, they're reducing these phonological rules. But the speakers do it too. Yeah.
I can't help but wonder whether you arrived one generation too late, in the sense that something must account for the difference between the described variety and the input variety, right?
In my research, I'm focusing on the learners. I was not planning on looking at the input in the way that I have. Right. I do think it's a mix of shift-induced language change, imperfect acquisition, right. Language attrition, but I'm not trying to
right.
disentangle that.
But I think in a way, that issue has been pushed back one generation. Because what you're saying is that the learners here are doing pretty good given the input variety. But evidently, the learners from the previous generation may not have done so well in the sense that they seem to have changed the language quite dramatically, assuming that the described variety was.
That's not an assumption that I'm necessarily making, and I don't think language change is a dirty word.
No, it need not be. The question is, what are the factors that contribute to it? The factors
yeah.
that contribute to it are inadequate input, for example, or knowledge of another language.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different story from language change where it's entirely in a monolingual environment. And you know, some of the changes that take place there are, in a sense, typologically expected. So the way they're expressing possession, for example, with their data, that's one of the two most common ways to express possession cross-linguistically. One is with a have-type verb, and the other is with that data.
Mm-hmm.
So something very principled is going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And must have taken place prior to, you know,
I think the seeds of change were sown prior, and
right.
Now they're slowly continuing through the generations.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, thank you.
Just following up on that question, have you thought about talking to the speakers and getting like a sort of educational family history?
Yes, I have. So I've been interviewing the speakers and asking them questions about where they grew up, what school they went to, how many siblings they have, are they the oldest or the youngest, who were they raised by. There are kinship connections amongst the speakers. There's probably some correlation between, you know, there's definitely, I think there are correlations, and I've been collecting those interviews for future work.
Yeah, I think it's a really rich project.
Carrie, I'm going to put other hand first.
So thinking about the theme of the conference, linking language and well-being, I'm wondering, in your view, how does the analysis of people's language relate to or support their well-being?
I'm hoping that I view my research as a way of just supporting the language valorization program, so anything that I discover, I give over to them to do with as they want. I don't feel comfortable in being in a position to make any recommendations or anything like that. I think language change is something that needs to be talked about more, and the way it's happening and the acceptance of it as well.
The word inevitable about language change,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't it simply depend on current speakers and future speakers who hold language learners, whether they want to go back to the described variety because they value it? Because where we work in the Northern there is a modern variety, but everybody, many people remember and value.
Mm-hmm. I think language change is in some ways unavoidable, but also unpredictable. So there are some things that the learners or that the speakers do that's different from the described variety. And in the learner varieties, they are probably a little closer to the described variety. They do have access to that dictionary. They have access to the grammar book that are based on the described variety. And at the end of the day, they're deciding how they're speaking the language. So if they decide they want to incorporate some of the described variety more so than what the speakers are doing, that's their choice.
Good, yeah. wondering if you can talk about maybe the kinds of conversations that you've been privy to about language change in the community, because I know that issue can vary a lot, I mean, sort of from community to community, right? Like attitudes and outlooks.
How the speakers feel about changes?
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't been looking at that as much. Carrie had a quote this morning, actually. So there was another Chickasaw presentation this morning, and she had a quote from a speaker that was, they felt originally that things were happening to the language, and this wasn't good, but then they kind of later changed their mind and felt like language revitalization and language reclamation were good. Every speaker is different. I also, like, I've been tracking whether the speakers, how they react when a learner makes a variation or makes a change, right? So do they jump in and correct it? Do they understand it? How do they react to that? And every speaker is different in how they react to the variations. I've also been doing grammaticality judgment tests with the speakers to see what they think. And every speaker is different. Every day is different. I think the academy is its own speech community that's renegotiating how to speak the language. So the speakers in the academy are, they're the only ones that I've really had access to. I don't know how people outside of the academy feel about it.
How many people in your nation, and how many you would say are fluent speakers, and how many are actively learning, but just over the whole population?
Well, for Chickasaw Nation, there's around 50 fluent speakers out of a tribal population of, I think, 63,000. I think the estimated number of people who are maybe not fully fluent but have some knowledge of the language is around 300. I don't know if there are any estimates for learners, though.
Another question is, as they're learning, or they're sort of learning the language, but those fluent people that are you want them to maintain and not lose any of it, what types of environments do you have where people learning can speak it, or the fluent people, and so you're not going up in competition against like video games in English or Hollywood in English, but other places where they can actually use the language, because that's ultimately what you're learning, it is to do something with it.
Everyone involved in the academy is an employee of the language revitalization program, so the speakers are full or part-time, and all the learners are full-time employees. And the goal is for the learners who come out of the academy to go on and continue using language in different ways for the language revitalization program, so language would continue to be a part of their life and a part of their everyday.
Probably have time for one more question, and I have a question, I can jump in. I was wondering, first of all, this is a phenomenal example of learners putting in hundreds and hundreds of hours in their effort to become speakers, and I really applaud your program. How many hundreds of hours is the program? How many years?
Mm-hmm.
And which which benchmark system do you use? ACTFL or
the benchmarks are, I'm pretty sure they're using basically the actual definitions, and they're assessed by the language revitalization program regularly with an oral interview, and the language revitalization program is the one that assesses them according to those benchmarks. So that's where I got the different assessments from. When the academy first started, their goal was to get 20 hours a week. As I said, the learners are full-time, so that seems like that should happen. But there's holidays, and there's life, and there's other parts of their job, so I think they average more around like 12 hours a week. So like I said, at the end of Jason's first year, he had 600 contact hours. So if you were getting 20 hours a week, you'd be more like 1,000, but it ended up at 600. So after 2 years, they should have about 1,200 contact or immersion hours.
600 per year?
That's what it looks like right now, after the first year.
Yeah. That's all the time we have. Just so you guys have a quick question.